Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So this will be the last lecture on chapter 4, right? Chapter 4 on the demand and supply and markets. If the price increases, demand will decrease. True or false? No, that's false. If the price increases, demand will decrease. Why is that a false statement? Yes, exactly right, exactly right. See, when price changes, does demand change? No. What changes? The quantity demanded changes, right? So if the price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, correct? But not demand itself. Now, what would have to happen in a general sense, a general statement, what would have to happen for demand to change?
Factor other than price.
Yes, exactly right. A factor other than a change in price would have to take place. Something would have to change other than price. That's when we have a whole shift in the curve. So now what kinds of things could change that will cause a shift in the demand curve? Well, that's what we've got. So these are the six things that we talked about already that would cause a shift in the curve itself. These are what your author calls non-price determinants. For example, the number in the market would change. If there's more people in the market, then there's a tendency for demand to increase, correct? And vice versa. If consumers' income changes, then there'll be a change in demand. And when we say income, which income do we mean? Real income, okay? Prices of a related good can change. See, not the price of the good in question, but if a related good changes, then that will cause a shift in the demand curve for the first. Now, which way will demand shift? Well, that depends on whether the two goods are related as complements or substitutes, right? And of course, consumer expectations is always a powerful force. If consumers' expectations change about what is going to happen in the future, that can cause a shift in demand curves. And demographics is the example I gave was the difference between Florida and Maine, right? In Florida, there'd be a big demand curve for air conditioners, but not so much for heaters. But in Maine, there might be a big demand for heaters, but not so much for air conditioners. Why? Well, because the demographics of those two states are different. And, of course, consumer tastes and preferences can change. And that can shift demand curves. So these are the six non-price determinants that we talked about when we're talking about demand. Now with supply, you got to have a split personality, right? Demand's got nothing to do with supply, and supply's got nothing to do with demand. When we're looking at the supply curve, what group are we looking at? The group that is doing the supplying, right? This is not the demanders, but the group that's doing the supplying. And once you understand that, then why is it that if the price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up? And you can answer that in one word. What's the one word? Yes, that's the word I was looking for. Incentive. Incentive. As the price goes up, the supplier has a greater incentive to increase the quantity supplied. And how do we know that? Because we know that as the price goes up, we know that as the market dictates a higher price, the supplier can make more money, can make higher profits, and therefore will have a greater incentive to produce more of that product. Because entrepreneurs are going to move into those areas where not only are they making a profit, but where they will make the most profit. And as price goes up, the potential for money-making profits go up, and more suppliers will enter into that industry, or those suppliers that are already there may supply more So the quantity supplied goes up. Now, how do we know for certain that as the price goes up, supplier will make more profits? Because we always make the assumption that other things are constant, that all else remains the same. There's a Latin term sometimes used for this called ceteris paribus, but it all means that when we change price, then that's the only thing that's changing. We assume that nothing else changes. So if you're the supplier of something and your costs stay the same, but the price of your product is going up in the market, then what has to happen? You've got to be making more money, right? More profits, which will give you greater incentive to increase the quantity supply. Now, of course, the opposite is true, and we can carry it to the extreme. If price goes down, price goes down, price goes down, and price goes down next to zero, well, how much incentive would the suppliers have to supply? Yeah, none, see? So that explains why supply curves have a positive slope, and that there is what we call a direct relationship between price and quantity when viewing supply curves. The price goes up, the quantity supply goes up. Price goes down, the quantity supply goes down. That's the opposite as with demand curves, right? With demand curves, we have an inverse relationship between price and quantity. Price goes up, the quantity demand goes down. Price goes down, the quantity demand goes up. See, demand curves, inverse relationship, supply curves, direct relationship between price and quantity. So, true or false, if price goes up, true or false, if price goes up, supply goes up. No, that's false. Why is that false?
Because they're not
going to
buy as much.
No, that's got nothing to do with demand. This is suppliers. Yes, you see. When price increases, does supply change? No. What changes? The quant supply, in this case, the quantity supply changes, right? When price changes, the quantity changes, but not the curve itself. Now, what would have to happen for the supply curve to change? Yeah, something would have to happen, something would have to change other than price, correct? Again, your author calls this a non-price determinant. Something would have to change other than price. Well, what kinds of things would have to change other than price? Well, here we have five reasons listed that could cause a shift in supply curves. The first here is technology can change. A change in technology can cause supply to either increase or decrease. You know, before I came to class, I was watching the fellow that founded Amazon, Jeff Bezos, and you know, the Kindle is. I mean, they can't make enough of those Kindle, those reading devices. I mean, they produce a bunch, and right away they're sold out, and so they produce a whole bunch more, and right away they're sold out, and they just, you know, well, see. That's, you know, the technology is there. Well, now people know that they can download books. Any book that Amazon sells on their website can be downloaded to the Kindle for an average price of $9. And the Kindle will hold over 1,000 books. So that's technology, right? Well, you know, if technology changes, what's happened to the supply of Kindles on the market? They've greatly increased, you see. Why? Because of change in technology. You know, a couple of years ago, this wasn't possible, but technology now has made it possible. A second reason that caused a shift in supply curves is the price of relevant resources. I guess I can't. Now, what is a relevant resource? Well, a relevant resource is some resource that is relevant to whatever it is you're supplying. Now, for example, if you consider a farmer that's, planting vegetables What would a relevant resource be? Seeds, fertilizer, soil,
equipment.
See, all yes, you're right in all of these. All of these would be, you know, relevant resources. Now, if, for example, if the price of a certain seed goes up, like a corn seed goes up, I don't know why that would happen, but if it did, what would happen to the supply of corn? It would go down, you see. Exactly right. Or if the price of fertilizer goes up, then there might be a decline in some agricultural products, right? See? So when there's a change in the price of a relevant resource, then there's a change in the supply of one thing or another. That's what we call a relevant resource, change in the price of thereof. And the third thing here, reason that will cause a shift in supply curves, is the price of alternative goods. Now, again, a farmer would be a good example of this. If you're a farmer, what would be an example of alternative goods? More we're talking about, you've got land, and on this land you can grow
corn.
Hundreds of different. Yeah, right. See, so alternative goods would be, well, I can grow corn or I can grow cabbage. Those are alternative goods. Now, if the price of corn goes up, let's say farmers are planting both corn and cabbage. But the price of corn goes up. No, if the price of corn goes up, you'll plant more corn. See, you're the supplier. Remember, you gain from the higher price.
If that's if everything remains constant.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So if as the price of alternative goods change in the market, and again, see, it's not the producer that's causing these changes in price, but it's the market that's causing the change in these prices. When the market causes a change in these prices of, you know, you're a farmer and you can plant this or you can plant that, well, as prices of these agricultural products change, then that's going to influence your decision of what to plant. See, around in the springtime, around this time of the year, here we are in February, right? Well, in February, farmers are going to have to make some decisions. Well, what am I going to plant this year? Am I going to plant corn or am I going to plant, cabbage or tomatoes? Because the same land will grow all those crops, right? So what a farmer does is he looks out there and says, well, what has happened to the prices of these things? And that's going to influence his decision. And reason that will cause a shift in supply curves is producer expectations. So this is the same as with the consumer and with the demand curve, but we are talking here about the producer. If the producer has got to make decisions, and no one can tell the future for sure, correct? I mean, we can all take educated guesses, but no one can really tell for certain what's going to happen in the future. So, what do we base so many of our decisions on?
Educated
guesses and our expectations of what we think is going to happen in the future. So, for example, if you're a farmer and you think the price of corn is going to increase, then maybe you'll decide to grow more corn. I mean, in the early spring and late winter, you say, well, considering this and considering that, I really think the price of corn is going to increase. Like it might be government policy, with the ethanol industry and government, passing laws, forcing gasoline to have a certain amount of ethanol in it, and that greatly increases the need for corn. And so what happens to the price of corn? Well, if you think that's going to happen before the planting season, and you're the farmer, what are you going to do?
Plant more corn,
you see. So these supply curves can shift to the right or shift to the left as expectations change. And the last reason is number of producers in the market. Now, the more producers in the market, you know, the more businesses we have that's doing the supplying, then what would the tendency be? No. Well, the number in the market, the more we have in the market, see, we're talking about a shift in supply curves. So the more producers we have in the market, what's going to happen to the supply curve? It's going to shift to the right. The fewer producers in the market, then there's a tendency for the supply curve to shift to the left. All right? So these are five factors that can cause a shift in supply curves. Again, these are what are called non-price determinants. When price changes, we have a change in what? We have a change in the quantity supply. But if something changes other than price, then we have a change in the supply itself. Okay? All right. So what happens when we put demand and supply together? So now what we're going to do, see, there are three parts of this chapter, right? There was a demand in the first third of the chapter, supply in the second third, and then in the last third, we're going to put demand and supply together and talk about the market. Now, see, demand in itself has nothing to do with supply, and supply in itself has nothing to do with demand, but together they determine what is called the market price. And that's what we're going to look at now. So what happens when we put the demand and supply together? We have something called an equilibrium is established. Now, here is a key term in economics, very important term. What does the equilibrium mean? No. It means a tendency toward. Yeah. An equilibrium is, like the equilibrium price would be the price toward which the economy tends. That's a very, very important concept in economics. It doesn't mean that two things are equal. It means that there's a tendency toward a certain point. Okay? Now, like, you know, for example, if this pen here were on equilibrium, and we moved away from the equilibrium, like over here, what would happen? Well, we would shift back down, back toward the equilibrium. And if we were over here, what would happen? We would shift back toward the equilibrium. Why? Well, because that's what equilibrium means. An equilibrium means a tendency toward. If we're not there, then there's a tendency to move back toward it. And if we're already there, there's little tendency to move away from it. See, there's two ways of looking at this concept of an equilibrium. One is, if you're not there, then there's a tendency to tend back toward it. The other way of looking at it is, if this point is an equilibrium and we are there, then there's little tendency to move away from it. Okay. Now, we're going to use this concept here in explaining the market price. See, what is an equilibrium? An equilibrium is a point toward which the economy tends. Okay, I just talked about that. Now, what does the term disequilibrium mean? Well, disequilibrium simply means that we're not at the equilibrium. You know, there's a certain equilibrium point, but we're not there. So we say, well, we are in a disequilibrium situation. Now, if we're in a disequilibrium situation, what's going to happen? We're going to tend back toward the equilibrium, right? Okay? So now, what is a surplus? Yeah, exactly. A surplus is an excess quantity supplied over quantity demanded at a given price. In other words, there's more units being supplied than being demanded. If there's more units being supplied than being demanded, then we say that we have a surplus. And why is a surplus a disequilibrium? And therefore, well, now what's going to happen? If you own a business and you found yourself with a big surplus, what are you going to do?
Sell it for cheaper.
Sell it for cheaper, right? You're going to lower the price. You know, let's say that it costs you $60 to produce something. And let's say you're trying to sell it for $100. Now, you'll sell some units for $100, but you still find yourself, they're not moving very quickly, and your warehouse is full of, you know, let's say we're talking about widgets. So your warehouse is full of widgets. Now, say you're losing money because it costs you money to produce these widgets. And if you don't sell them, then you're out all the money that you put in to produce them, correct? All right, so you're not selling them very quickly, and so you lower your price to 90. Well, you sell a few more for 90. You know, your sales picks up some, but you still got a warehouse here full of these widgets, and so you lower your price to maybe 70. Then you lower your price to maybe 60. Now, it costs you $60 to make this, correct? Would you lower your price to 50 if need be?
Yeah.
Well, sure you would, because if you, I mean, let's say the price is 60, but you still got, you know, 1,000 widgets that you can't sell. So let's say each widget costs you $1 a piece to make the math simple. So that's $1,000 that you're out, right? If you don't sell these widgets, you're out $1,000. And if you keep the price at 60, you're out $1,000. But if you lower your price to $50, you'll sell the widgets. Now, if you sell them, how much will you lose? Well, I forgot the math there, but you'll lose money, right? But will you lose as much money if you didn't sell them at all? See, it's better to lower your... How much it costs you to produce this widget is what we call a sunk cost. It's a sunk cost, and therefore it has no relevance in our decision of what price to charge. Okay? Because whatever it cost us, it cost us. I mean, that's a sunk cost. And we've learned that when we make decisions, we don't consider sunk costs because they're irrelevant to our decision making.
But you would go in there thinking that you're going to at least make your money back.
It's better to lose a little than lose a lot. I mean, their company. I mean, this is the name of the game in today's market. I mean, have you noticed all the sales we've gotten? I mean, my wife has gone. I mean, she's like. You know, it's a shopping paradise. I mean, you know, she's buying clothes and, you know, you can buy clothes today new clothes at prices that are even less than you can at the Goodwill. I mean, prices of clothing has gone way down. Well, you know that those companies are selling this clothing for less than it costs them to produce in the first place. But they would rather lose a little bit than lose a lot. I mean, if they were to keep the price at this higher price, maybe they won't sell nearly as many and they'll lose a lot of money. But if they lower the price, they're still going to lose money, but they'll lose less money. See? But the point here is that when we have a surplus, then the producer is going to lower the price in order to get rid of the surplus. And that's why we call having a surplus a disequilibrium situation. Now, what is a shortage? Well, a shortage is when we have excess of quantity demanded over the quantity supplied at a given price. A shortage says there's more units being demanded than being supplied. Now, in a free market, when we have a shortage, how do we decide who gets? Who's going to get? Okay, now who is it that's going to pay the most money? Those who need it or want it, and those who can afford it. Exactly. See, it takes both, right? It takes a want to, and it takes the ability in terms of money. So when we have a shortage, what happens? It's like at an auction. I mean, if you have an auction and the auctioneer is, you know, trying to auction off, you know, this or that, well, there's not enough for everybody, right? And let's say there's a lot of people that want whatever is being auctioned off. So at an auction, who gets? Yeah. And who are those who pay? People bid the price up, right? Someone says, well, I'll give you $100. And I says, well, I'll give you $110. And someone says, well, I'll give you $140. And so, you know, they bid the price up, and eventually someone's going to be the highest bidder, and they're the ones who get, right? Well, this is the way prices work. And by the way, you know, there's some fantastic auctions. I've got a friend that has a friend that just bought a $1 million house in Florida for $100,000. I mean, 2 years ago, the same house was selling for $1 million, and he bought at auction for $100,000. I mean, there's some great deals going on. You know, in today's market, cash is king. I mean, if you've got the, you know, cash or even good credit, there's all kinds of good, you know, good deals out there. I mean, in real estate, boy, you can pick up. There's houses in Michigan they're selling for less than $100, whole houses that, you know, several years ago would have been like $70,000-$80,000. I mean, the market in Michigan is so depressed, and people are upside down their mortgages and all this and all that, and I mean, and banks don't want these houses, and so you know what an absolute auction is? An absolute auction is, huh? Yeah, everything has to go, and whoever the highest bidder gets. Period. I mean, some auctions have a minimum price. They say, well, you know, this is an auction, but we're not going to take less than, you know, this price. But an absolute auction is everything must go. Whatever, you know, who's ever the highest bidder is the highest bidder. I mean, I coming out of, you know, my place in I live in Radford, and just not too far, they just put up a sign and they're auctioning off two big apartment buildings. One's 11 units and the other's 14 units. Now, I don't know if that's an absolute auction or not, but somebody's going to get a good deal there. So this is how markets work, all right? So we're talking about the market. And when there's a shortage, then the highest bidder gets, and what happens is that the price is bidded up. So why is a shortage a disequilibrium? Well, we just talked about it. If there's a shortage, it's a disequilibrium because price is going to go up as people bid against one another. So what is market equilibrium? The condition that exists in a market when the plans of the buyers match the plans of the sellers. Well, this is one way of defining what an equilibrium is, but we're going to talk more. I'm going to give you some illustrations here because it goes deeper than just a simple explanation. But anyway, here is a picture. It's a graph, and on this graph here, we've got our downward slope and demand curve. And we talked about why demand curves got a negative slope, right? We have an upward slope in supply curve. And we talked about, you know, why supply curves have a positive slope. And according to this graph, it's at 75 cents, the quantity demanded equals the quantity supply. And we know that 75 cents is the equilibrium price. Now, how would you prove to me that 75 cents is in equilibrium? Let's say I don't know anything about this, and you show me this graph. Okay, here's the demand curve, here's the supply curve, and where they cross, they cross at 75 cents. Well, how would you explain to me that 75 cents is the equilibrium? Well, now, if the equilibrium point is the point that we tend toward, like the equilibrium price is the price toward which the market tends, then how would you prove that? You would simply move away from it. So you move away from it, and then you observe what happens. So let's move away from it. Let's go above 75 cents. Let's go up to maybe a dollar. Now, as price goes up, what do demanders say to themselves? No, demanders. As price goes up, as price goes up, what's going to happen? You know, the demander is going to say, hey, we don't want as much, right? I mean, as a consumer, as the price goes up on things, you say, well, I can't afford to buy as much, or I don't want to buy as much, right? But see here, I didn't talk about consumers. See, on purpose, I didn't talk about consumers. I talked about demanders because does the demand curve always represent the consumer? No. Who demands labor? Business, right? Businesses demand labor. Well, are businesses consumers? Not as a business, no. Say the demand curve isn't always the consumer, but it is always the group that's doing the demanding, whatever it is you're talking about. So here, let's say the price goes up from 75 cents to a dollar. So demanders say, hey, we don't want as much. So the quantity demanded goes down. But what does the supplier say to themselves? Come on now. If price goes up from 75 cents to a dollar, what does supplier say to themselves? Well, suppliers say, hey, we want to supply more. Now, why does the supplier want to supply more? More money, right? They're in business to make a profit, correct? As price goes up, then their profits will go up, correct? So they have a greater incentive as the price increases, correct? Well, as demanders saying we want less and a supplier saying we want to supply more, what eventually happens? No, we're going above the equilibrium. See, look at the graph here. What's going to happen?
A surplus,
right? I mean, demanders saying that we don't want to buy as much. Suppliers saying we want to supply more. And at some point, it's going to be evident that we have a surplus. Well, when we have a surplus in a free market, how do we get rid of the surplus?
Lower the price.
So what's going to happen to the price? It's going to go back down toward 75 cents. Now, let's say the price goes down to 50 cents. Now, as the price goes down, what do suppliers say to themselves?
It doesn't remain constant, right?
Well, no. As the price goes down, what do suppliers say to themselves?
They want to buy more.
No, suppliers.
Oh, if the price goes down, then they're not going to want to produce as much?
Right. See, if the price goes down, the supplier says, we don't want to produce as much. We don't want to supply as much at the lower prices. Why? Well, because they're making less money at those lower prices. Remember, when we change price, we assume everything else stays the same, right? So their costs are the same. So when price goes down, they're making less money. So they have less incentive. But as price goes down, what do demanders say to themselves?
We want more.
Well, the supplier is saying, we're going to supply less. and demand are saying, we want to buy more, what happens?
Right,
well, look at the graph now. What happens?
Shortage.
And in a free market, when there's a shortage, how do we decide who gets? Yeah, the price mechanism kicks in. The highest bidder gets, and the highest bidder are those with the most money and those who want it the most. But the upshot of this thing is that price goes back up towards 75 cents. So what have we proven here? We've proven that 75 cents is an equilibrium. Right? Y'all see that? Okay. Now, what causes an increase in equilibrium price? An increase in demand or a decrease in supply? See, the equilibrium price can change. So here we have another graph, and we've got a downward sloping demand curve and a positive slope supply curve, and the equilibrium is at 75 cents, right? But now what happens if, gracious, what happens if demand increases from D to D prime? What happens to the equilibrium price? It goes up. See, not only does the price go up, but the equilibrium price goes up. Now, what would cause this movement to the right of the demand curve? If you weren't specific, as a general statement, what would cause a shift to the right of the demand curve? No, general statement. Not specific, but something would have to change other than price, right? One of these six non-price determinants would have to change, correct? Or a combination of them. But that's what would cause a shift to the right of the demand curve. Now, when demand curve shifts to the right, then you see this shifts the equilibrium from 75 cents to a dollar. And by the way, I ask you a question, and the question is here, why is a dollar the new equilibrium? And you say, well, the dollar is an equilibrium because that's where demand now equals supply. But see, that's not an answer to the question. Now, if I ask you, where is the equilibrium price, then you say, it's at a dollar because that's where demand, the quantity demanded, equals the quantity supplied. But if I say, why is a dollar the equilibrium price, then what do you have to do?
Something other than the price thing?
No, you're just throwing out terms. If I say, why is a dollar the equilibrium price, how would you prove that to me? Yeah. You'd have to go above the price, right? And then you would have a surplus, and so you say, oh well, price come down, you've got a surplus, or you go below the price, and then that way you'd have a shortage. You say, oh, when we have a shortage, price would go up. You see, you have to. If I say why, then you got to move away from the equilibrium and show that we will tend back toward the equilibrium, because that's what equilibrium means, right? It means a tendency toward. Okay, now what about this? Here we've got another graph. We've got a downward slope and demand curve. This is slide 51, by the way, and upper slope and supply curve. And the equilibrium is where? The equilibrium price is 50 cents. But now what happens here when supply decreases from S to S prime? What happens to the equilibrium price? No, it was 50 cents. Yeah, it goes up. You see, the equilibrium price was 50 cents, but now it's 75 cents. So a shift to the left of the supply curve causes an increase not only in the price, but in the equilibrium price. All right? Now, see, on the test, you might have several questions like this. You say, well, this is the beginning market price, and demand increases, and so what happens to the equilibrium price? And all you got to do is look at the graph and just see. I mean, if you just downward slope in demand curve, upper slope in supply curve, shift to the right, shift to the left, view those curves, and the answer jumps right out at you. See? I mean, it's just mathematics. All right, what about this? What causes a decrease in equilibrium price? A decrease in demand or an increase in supply? So here, again, we've got another graph, a downward slope in demand curve, an upper slope in supply curve, and now the equilibrium price is at a dollar. But what happens if, gracious, what happens if demand declines? What happens to the equilibrium price? It goes down, right? To 75 cents. And by the way, what happens to the equilibrium quantity? It goes down from 24 units to 20 units. All right, here's another possibility. Again, downward slope in demand, upper slope in supply. The equilibrium is at 75 cents. But now what happens is that supply increases from S to S prime. What happens to the equilibrium price? And the equilibrium quantity goes up. All right? Now, here's a tip that you don't want to forget. What happens if both demand and supply changes? What happens to the equilibrium price if both demand and supply changes? For example, here is our beginning market price, correct? All right. Supply, demand increases a lot, and supply increases a little. Well, no, we got a new equilibrium, but the new equilibrium is a higher price. Now, here's a tip I don't want you to forget. If a question test says we got both an increase in demand and an increase in supply, and we're trying to figure out what result that would have on the equilibrium price, but the question says demand increases more than supply increases. Now, all you got to do is read that as an increase in demand. See what I mean? I mean, if demand increases more than supply increases, then the net result would be the same as if demand simply increased. Okay? So you don't have to think of this thing as a two-step reasoning. You don't have to say, okay, demand's increased this, supply's increased that, so what's going to result? I mean, you just, when one increases or decreases relative to the other, then you just, it's just the same as it increased or decreased, period. The result is the same. See, like in this case, if demand increases more than supply increases, then we have an increase in the equilibrium price and an increase in the equilibrium quantity. The same that would have resulted if demand simply increased. All right? Now, here's an increase in supply and demand, panel B. See, here's the beginning equilibrium price. Demand increases a little. Supply increases a lot. So what results? A lot. No, demand increases a little, supply increases a lot, so the not only the price, but the equilibrium price goes down, and the equilibrium quantity goes up. See? Which would be the same thing as if supply simply increased. Right? All right, now what we're going to do here is that we're going to look at some ways that we can use this information to analyze certain economic events. Actually, I guess there are, you can look at this as maybe four parts of this chapter. We talked about demand, and then we talked about supply, and then we talked about the market price or the equilibrium price. By the way, those two things are not the same. The equilibrium price and the market price are not really one in the same. And the reason for that is time lags. Time lags. It's another thing you got to understand about economics. There's always time lags. There's always three time lags. There's the recognition lag, the decision lag, and the action lag. It takes time for us to recognize that some change has taken place. And then it takes time for us to determine what to do about that change. And then it takes time for us to implement what we've decided to do. Now, if demand increases, the equilibrium price will instantaneously increase. But will the market price instantaneously increase? No, the market price won't. Why? Because of these time lags. See, if demand increases, we say, okay, the equilibrium price increases, but it takes time for us to recognize that, hey, a change has taken place. Oh, what are we going to do about that change? Oh, well, now let's put into action what we've decided to do. And then what happens to the market price? Then the market price will increase. So the market price is always chasing after the equilibrium price. The equilibrium price goes up. After a little time, after time lag, the market price goes up. The equilibrium price goes up. After a little time, the market price goes up. The equilibrium price goes down. Okay, after a time, the market price will start to come down. See what I mean? But there's these time lags. So when we talk about the equilibrium price and we talk about the market price, they're related in that the equilibrium price determines the market price, but they're not the same thing at all times. In fact, they're very rarely the same thing. In fact, is it possible that one could be going up while the other is coming down? Yeah, that's possible for these time lags. It's possible that the equilibrium price goes up, market price goes up. Equilibrium price, market price goes up. Equilibrium price goes down, but because of these time lags, the market price is still going up. But then after a little while, we'll make these changes, and then the market price will start to come down. See what I mean? But for a short time, they could actually move in opposite directions. But the fourth part of this chapter is okay, you know, we've talked about demand, we've talked about supply, we've talked about the equilibrium price, you know, and the market price. Now, let's talk about some ways that we can use this information to better understand how the world works. Because really, isn't that the bottom line of what this thing is all about? I mean, aren't we studying economics to get some idea of how the world works and to know what is truth and what's untruth? And so that's what we're going to do next at some key examples. So the first thing we're going to talk about is what's called a price floor. Now, what is a price floor? A price floor is a minimum legal price below which a good or service cannot be sold. A minimum legal price. Now, what makes it legal or illegal? Government, right? Government, you know, passes a law and says this is legal, this is illegal. Now, what would be a good example of a price floor when you're thinking about, you know, government mandates? It could be a product or a service. But what would be a good example? I mean, the best example I can think of is the minimum wage law. I mean, don't we have a minimum wage law in this country? And, the government says, in these cases, an employer has to pay at least this amount in wages, right? That's called a minimum wage law. Now, what is the purpose of minimum wage laws? I mean, socially, politically, what's the purpose of minimum wage laws? So that certain people will make more than they would otherwise, correct? Okay, you know, we're helping that unskilled maybe uneducated person that would otherwise make a very, very low wage, and we're going to help him and so that he makes a higher wage. But let's see what the consequences are of a price floor. Here we have the demand curve for labor. Now, are we talking here about all labor? If you're talking about the minimum wage law, what labors are we considering? Well, the low income, unskilled, uneducated, right? Little experience. I mean, not everybody is subject to the minimum wage. I mean, hopefully, you're here in college because you want to be a professional, right? Later in life. Well, I mean, is the minimum wage law going to apply to you? Well, hopefully not, right? Or you've just wasted, a lot of time and money. So we're not talking here about all labor. We're talking about, a certain sector of the labor force. Anyway, here we've got the demand for this type of labor, and we got the supply for this type of labor, and we have an equilibrium wage. But then the government comes along and says, no. We're dissatisfied with this equilibrium wage, so we're going to mandate a price above the equilibrium. Now, this is what we call a price floor. Now, this may be a little confusing because the price floor is above the equilibrium price, but the floor says we're not going to allow price to fall below this level. See, so it's a floor. Y'all with me on this? It's a floor because you say, okay, we're not going to fall below. So the government says, we're not going to allow the wage to fall below $6 an hour. Well, if the equilibrium wage were lower than $6 an hour, and after all, why would we have a law if that weren't the case, right? I mean, why have a minimum wage law if we set the minimum wage lower than the equilibrium wage? I mean, that would make no sense, would it? I mean, if the whole purpose of the law is so that wages are higher than they would be otherwise, then in order for the law to be effective, the price has to be above the equilibrium price, correct? So in this case, we're saying, okay, the mandated price is $6 an hour. Well, assuming here that that is above the equilibrium, what has to result? A surplus, right? Right? See, I mean, here's we got demand curve for labor, supply curve for labor. We got an equilibrium wage, but we say, no, we're not satisfied with that. We're going to mandate a higher wage. So with a price floor of $6 an hour, we at the same time have mandated a surplus. Well, a surplus of what? Well, a surplus of workers. Now, every time the government does something like this, we got winners and we got losers. Now, who are the winners in this game?
Workers.
Which workers?
The ones that are getting lower than minimum
wage. No, higher than minimum wage. What did I say? Winners or losers? Who are the winners? The winners are those who are making more, right, than they would without the law, correct?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a minimum wage law. These workers are making more than they would otherwise.
Right.
So they are the winners. But who are the losers?
People pay them.
No. See, when we say surplus here, surplus of what? And so what have we got here? Unemployment, right? There are some workers here that would have got a job at the lower wage, but now don't have a job at the higher wage. Right? So can we go out there and can we find the losers? Yeah, they're out there. See, we got winners and we got losers. Some people gain, some people lose. This is almost always the case when the government dictates things. When the government dictates, the market has a way of deciding how things work. But then when the government comes along and says, well, we're not happy with the way the market's dictating things, we want to dictate things, and when the government does that, you've ultimately got winners and you've got losers. Some people gain and some people lose. In this case, those who are making higher wage gain. Those people that can't find jobs, that would have found jobs at lower wage, lose. But you do have winners and losers. Okay? And a simple, it's just simple mathematics. Simple mathematics of what we talked about with the market. All right, so what is a price ceiling? A price ceiling is a maximum legal price above which a good or service cannot be sold. So that's the opposite of a price floor. Now, here again, we've got a downward sloping demand curve, upper sloping supply curve, and where they meet is the equilibrium price. But the government comes along and says, no, we're not happy with this equilibrium price, but we're going to mandate a lower price. Now, this is called a price ceiling when the price is below the equilibrium price, because we're saying prices can't go above this ceiling. Now, the market would dictate a price above that ceiling price, but the law says, no, we're not going to let price go above this certain amount. Now, a good example of price ceilings would be rent control. You know, certain cities have imposed rent control, like New York City and Los Angeles, San Francisco, and you know they look out there and they say, well, you know, we're going to mandate that landlords can't charge more than this amount of money for these apartments. Now, what is the purpose? I mean, politically, what is the purpose of rent control? Fairness, yeah. You know, we want people pay lower rents than they would otherwise, right? Now let's look at this. Again, it's just simple mathematics. If the price ceiling is below the equilibrium price, and of course it's going to be, otherwise why have the law, right? I mean, you know what? Why set a ceiling if it's going to be equal to or above the equilibrium price? I mean, that would make no sense at all. So, assuming here that this ceiling is lower than the equilibrium price, what has to result? A shortage. You see, with the lower price. See, as the price is lower, you know, as the rents that landlords can receive is lower, what do the landlords say to themselves? Come on, if you're a potential landlord and rents were going down and lower than you would like, then what do you say to yourself? Is it written in stone? Is it a law that you have, as an investor, you have to have your money in rental property? No, I mean, you're an entrepreneur, right? And you're simply looking for a good deal. And if rental property is a good deal, that's what you do. But if you can take your money elsewhere and get higher returns, then that's what you're going to do, right? So as rents go down and down and down and are much lower than the market would dictate, what do landlords say to themselves? Well, we don't want to supply as much, right? We'll take our money elsewhere. And so what happens is that the quantity supplied goes down. But at the same time, what do people who are demanding rental units, potential renters, as the rents go down in a locality like New York, a city, as rents go down, what do renters, potential renters, say to themselves? We want more, right? Lower, price goes down, rents go down. Hey, we can afford more. We want more. Well, with renters wanting more, but suppliers supplying less, what has to result? A shortage, you see. Now that we've got a shortage in the free market, how would we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Most money. But is this a free market? No, it's not a free market. See, it's government mandated. And so So the price is not going to go up. So what have we done? Well, what we've done is that we have really mandated a persistent shortage. Now again, we got winners and we got losers. Now who are the winners in this game? Are not no not the no there's a shortage. So who are the winners? See, if you want an apartment, you'd be a loser because, well, there's not
many apartments. People that are given the apartment, the investors.
Well, no, the investors are losing because they're getting less rent than they would. But who are the winners? The winners are those who already have rental. You know, they're already renters, right? And they are paying less rent than they would otherwise. And their apartment is still well taken care of. Now, they would be the winners, right? I mean, they're paying less rent than they would otherwise. They've got, you know, a rental unit. They're not looking. They've already got one. They're living there. And we'll assume that the apartment's well taken care of. So they are definitely the winners. But who are the losers? Everybody else, which is those who are maybe newly moving into the area and they're looking for apartments, but there's such a great shortage that, hey, there's hardly any available.
So
see?
Why would nobody want to invest in the apartment? Like, then you would have no, like,
you'd have a chronic shortage. See, that's what we're saying.
But, like, say if I've already got this apartment for you and you don't want to, invest in these apartments anymore, so you go somewhere else and nobody picks up that investment anymore.
Now that's a problem.
That's
a problem, and you really hit on a good point there because maybe there's not going to be anyone who want to buy my apartment because of the rent, you know, the rent control. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe see, that really brings me into the next point, because with the landlords receiving less rent than they would otherwise, as these apartments get older, what happens to the cost of maintaining these apartments? It goes up. You know, the roof needs replacing. Things deteriorate, right? And so it's just like an older car. The expense of maintaining these places go up, but yet your rent is frozen at a low level. So now you're making losses, and you say, "Well, I want out of this thing," but who's going to buy that from you if it's a losing situation? And so what happens is that, well, different things can happen. One thing is that landlords simply leave. I mean, they just give up on it and let the building go. And you see, if the roof leaks, is the landlord's not going to fix it because it's not cost feasible. Is government going to fix the leaky roof? No. Because they say, well, it's not our apartment, you know, it's this landlord's apartment. Well, are the tenants going to fix the leaky roof? Well, no, they're not, because they don't own it, and so what happens? Well, that's one reason why some of these large cities have such slums. They have slums because, well, no one takes care of these places, and they just deteriorate, and so or the other option would be for the landlord to hire a professional firebug, and he burns the place down, and they collect the insurance. And that's common common too in these big cities.
So why wouldn't the government just raise the higher price ceiling? Like, rather than let that happen, why wouldn't they just
you got a good question. So that brings me into the next point I was going to make. Based on what we've studied in this chapter, see, what was our objective with the rent control? People would have hopefully good apartments and paying less rent than they would otherwise, correct?
Right.
Now, how could we accomplish that without rent control? That would lead to more rental property, lower rents, and the apartments would be well taken care of.
How would you?
Yeah. Huh? More what?
Morals.
Yeah. Oh, no. But I mean, if you were government now, if you were government, and your objective was to have more rental properties, lower rents, and those rental properties well taken care of, how could you do that?
Less taxes on the investors?
Less, boy, you're good. Less taxes on the investors, right? We could lower taxes on the investors, and then what would happen to the incentive for investors? What would happen to the supply curve of rental property? It would shift to the right, and what would happen? Rents would come down. Those apartments would be well taken care of because it's the equilibrium rent, right? See? And so we would accomplish our goal to have lower rents and those have no shortage. There's no shortage here because, with supply shifting to the right, we've got a new equilibrium, you see, at a lower rent. And so it's a win-win situation. Now, here is the major question. Let's get back to your question. Why rent control instead of lowering taxes on investors? Now, I'm a politician. And I come to you and I say, I want you all to have more rental property at lower rents, so I'm going to lower taxes on these landlords. You know, those people that got all this money, I mean, they got so much money, you know, they just, smoke cigars from $100 bills but I'm going to lower their taxes. Now, how many of you are going to vote for me? Yeah, I said, well, this guy is in favor of the rich, and I'm not going to give him my vote. Okay, now let's say I'm another politician, and I come to you and I say, look, these landlords are taking such advantage of you. You vote me in office, and I'm going to go after them, and I'm going to make them charge you a reasonable rent. See, I'm going to impose rent control. And I'm going to protect you. Now, how many of you are going to vote for me?
More than likely.
More than likely, because that sounds good. This guy here is going to take care of us. You know, he's going to make sure that we pay lower rents. So, politically, it's more advisable to come out with rent control programs as opposed to lowering taxes on investors, right? But notice the end result. If we're not going to lower taxes, if we instead have rent control, who loses? Well, we've got dilapidated apartments, right? They're now slums. We have a shortage of rental property. See. And not only that, but consider this. At what point does rent control begin?
Whatever.
It begins at the beginning, right? In other words, let's say you're a potential, a contractor, a potential landlord, and you want to build rental properties. And you know that once these rental properties are built, you're going to be subject to this rent control. Now, would you rather build low-income apartments and be frozen at those low rents or high-income apartments and be frozen at higher rents?
High-income.
Yeah. So, even when we do have new apartments built, who are they built for?
The rich.
The rich.
With the price ceilings, the investors don't get the lower taxes.
Well, with rent control, what we're saying is that we're simply mandating lower rents and not giving the investor a tax break. See, but the alternative would be not have rent control, but give the investor a tax break. So I guess what the lesson here is that there's a difference between And this is particularly true today with, government right today is, we've got this, $900 billion bailout package plus other increases in government spending. I mean, our deficit now is expected to increase to $2 trillion in just 1 year, in the year 2009, and last year it was only $10 trillion. So, I mean, we're greatly increasing the deficit in order to increase government spending. And when we've got government involvement like this, ask yourself this question. Are all of these thousands of decisions that have to be made, you know, where we're going to spend our money, how much we're going to spend it on, what programs we're going to support, what programs we're not going to support, who gets this, who gets that, how much of those decisions are going to be based on market forces and how many are going to be based on politics? Now, come on. Yeah, well, whatever, but you know that a good many of them are going to be based on simply politics. You know, I mean, that's why we've got so much what's called pork barrel spending. You know, so many. This spending bill ran about 1,100 pages, and our Congress had less than a week to decide to pass it or not. Now, how many of those politicians you think read the whole 1,100 pages and understood everything in there? Zero, right? Nobody read, in other words, no politician knew what was in that bill, at least not everything, when they voted for it, right? So what happened is you got pork barrel spending as well. You got, this politician deciding to, they got their special interest groups supporting them, and so they got these programs, and this politician's got their special interests and their pet programs and want to help people in their state or for this industry or that industry. And so that's what we call pork barrel spending. Now, all of that, what I'm saying is that all of that is based on what? Not on economics, but based on politics. As, was the case with rent control. Anyway, this does, you had a question? All right, well, this does end this chapter 4 here. So what are y'all going to do for next time?
Read chapter 5.
Read chapter 5, right? So I'll see you all next time.